Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Cutthrough Vine for July 8, 2012. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, rejoining the Cutthrough Vine off after a week on vacation. And, of course, y'all had a great show without me with my two regular co-hosts, Tim Shiflett. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
And Catherine Smith. Welcome, Catherine.
Welcome, everyone. Hello.
Yes,
welcome back, David.
And, good to be back. About vacation a little bit. I want to thank Wendy Davis for sitting in for me, and Scott Elliott was our guest, I know, and I know he had posted that he had been on. I saw that, so I know that everything went good there. But we're going to have a little more politics. And, of course, last week was July 4th, and July 4th is kind of a week in the summer where people kind of take off from political news. Now, of course, candidates go to every parade and go to every fireworks display and whatnot. But as far as making real hard news, it's a little quieter week traditionally. Maybe that's why I seem to always take my vacation on that week. That and the high school, middle school athletics have to be off as well. That's probably one of the few times those two things coincide. But there's still other things that go on, and we're here to discuss them. First thing that I want to do is I'll just a little bit of moment about my vacation and what I saw politically. I drove from Georgia up to South Dakota, and I went through state after state that you would consider a red state, with the exception of Iowa. I mean, I went through Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, southern Illinois, which Illinois is blue, but then southern Illinois is the redder part. Culturally, I guess it fits much more like a rural red state. Then went into Missouri, kind of a purple state, most swing state of the bunch. Went over to Kansas for supper, been back up into Iowa, South Dakota, all the way across the state. Went over to Wyoming, and on the way back I did stop in Nebraska. What I'm getting here is on this trip, of all these states, I saw not one single Romney for President bumper sticker. No support, no signs in anybody's yards. You know, no sign that anybody was excited about Mitt Romney. Now, I did see anywhere between a dozen and 20 Obama stickers, and they were new ones. I'm kind of trying to notice that when it's a new one or an old one, if you will. And I did see one defeat Obama, and I saw a Ron Paul or two. Actually, Ron Paul, who's not even in the race anymore, seems to still have more support than Mitt Romney. And my question to y'all, Catherine, if I go through this list of states I gave you, and I go to a place like Rapid City, which is a pretty red state vacation, if you will, with people all across the country going there, and that's where I did see the preponderance of the Obama stickers. In fact, if the support is just not there for Mitt Romney in a place like that, is it ever going to be there?
I don't think so. I just don't think people are excited about Governor Romney. You know, I think that, you know, the hardcore Republicans will get out and vote, but I don't think they're very excited about it. I think there's a lot of money flowing into the campaign, but not from ordinary voters. You know, they're getting a lot of money from the super PAC money and probably a lot of corporate contributions, but it just doesn't seem like there's much of a groundswell from, you know, however you want to call it, the grassroots or the, you know, ordinary citizens. There just doesn't seem to be very much excitement about him. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Kerry in 2004.
Yeah, and we'll get into that on some other comments made. Tim, if you noticed there, I went through three of the six states that make the Republican wall. I mean, from North Dakota to Texas, you have a area which is always Republican. And it's completely no sign of Romney support. What do I make of that?
You know, I don't know if it's organization or what, but I've even noticed that around here, David. Like in my county, I've seen 3 Obama yard signs out. Somebody's put them out. Seen no signs for Romney. Same thing down there in your county. And you and I both know, though, that Romney will handily carry both of those counties. What you're wondering about is if the opposition that this year is coming out to vote for Romney or against Obama. Well, I think the opposition this year is going to come out to vote against Obama, as we'll discuss a little later with what the Speaker of the House said. I don't think there's any great groundswell of love for Mitt Romney. I mean, the man is like watching paint dry. So.
Yeah, I just keep seeing this same trend. And when you see it, I know this is anecdotal, but when you see this in person in these states, you're just really glaring. And I guess, by the way, if you ever decide, hey, I want to go to rural America, and you're somebody that listens to us and you're, you know, live completely in blue state America, don't worry. You won't be Republican to death, at least with Mitt Romney on the ticket. I mean, you can go and enjoy, you know, Mount Rushmore and the Black Hills and the Badlands and everything else I saw. By the way, ate steak 2 nights ago in Warren Buffett's favorite steakhouse in Omaha, for what it's worth. But, you know, it's just something that I just saw, and I thought, well, you know, I got to mention this. Plus, it'll kind of give an excuse of what, you know, what I was doing off the show last week, if you will. Well,
David,
sure.
Can I ask you a question? So, even in Missouri, you didn't see much. Like, did you see much, like, about the Senate campaign in Missouri? Was there a lot of? Did there seem to be some attention to that? Because, you know, we've been talking about Missouri a lot. I just wonder if there seems to be any, you know, activity there for any of the political races.
Missouri, that's a good point, Catherine. Of all the states, Missouri had the most political signage and billboards. They're big into billboards there. John Bruner, which is one of the Republican candidates, he had some yard signs and some big signs. Maybe think Claire McCaskill, the Democrat, might need to get a little more on the stick, although, you know, signs don't vote. But they did have more signs. Now, particularly in the Kansas City area, they had a lot of local elections that apparently must be hotly contested. So that was, you know, the big place, if you will. I mean, places like Iowa, you wouldn't know it was even an election year. Now, this was only one part of Iowa. It was Council Bluff and Sioux City, if you're familiar. That's the far western border. But, you know, that was the real action, if you will. Kentucky, not much going on. Southern Illinois, non-existent. And so that was just the situation there. Now, y'all were kind of alluding to 2 different things that I sent you to talk about. One, John Boehner said, basically, I can't make you love Mitt Romney. Now, Bonnie Raitt sings a song, I can't make you love me if you won't, or if you don't. And this seemed like the same kind of thing for political stuff. You know, like, I can't give a speech and make you think that Mitt Romney's wonderful, but I still think he'll win presidency because people don't like President Obama. I'm beginning to be suspect of this, that people are going to say that basically if you look at the favorables and unfavorables, that people are going to turn out a person that they actually, as far as a person, is above water for a guy that's underwater. I begin to be suspect of this. Now, of course, I know in Republican rallies that it may be anybody but Obama may win. But, Tim, I've heard you say before, you can't beat somebody with nobody. And I think the Speaker in some ways is saying Mitt Romney's a nobody. Now, he's a nobody with some money, which usually nobodies don't have. But Speaker Boehner, what do you make of this? Is this like a real faux pas for the Romney campaign or for him and him getting along with Romney?
He tried to walk it back, you know, after he said it. But the Speaker is right. People are, like I said, they're going to be voting against the president and not for Romney. He's just not a charismatic type individual. he doesn't inspire passion in people one way or the other. And so I think his campaign has decided that the best way to run is his main job is simply not to fall flat of his face. A few gaffes like the penalty tax thing this week could just kill him. But he essentially hopes to run a campaign based on the economic conditions as they are in the country right now, and that'll be good enough to win. But if Republican voters this year are looking for someone to inspire them, that's not going to happen this year. This is not the year of the giver, right?
No, and you talk about somebody to inspire and talk about other things. That was mentioned by other people, and we'll get into that later too, is Romney is just a one-note candidate. It's just economy. And will that be enough, or do you need to add more to it, and how can he? Catherine, the speaker's comments. John Boehner, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, like Tim said, he did try to back away from what he was saying, but I think it's absolutely true. And I think that when you look at swing voters and we see the sort of weak message coming from the Romney campaign. Yeah, it's all about the economy, but we're not really hearing what it is all about with the economy. I think it may be an example of the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. A swing voter might not be 100% happy with President Obama, liked one of the other candidates that was running, but now that we've got Mitt Romney, and he's not really a very forceful candidate, they may just go, well, what the heck difference does it make? And I'll just vote for the guy who's already there. At least we'll have less of a transitional period or whatever. There's a lot of reasons you might vote that way. So, yeah, I think he is too weak in his he doesn't have any charismatic power. So I think he's in trouble. I mean, I hope he is, of course. But
yeah, and I know you're just doing the old adage, devil you know, devil you don't know. But I think it might be if you say, hey, the negative view that you could come up with your candidate might be the dreamer, maybe too much of the idealist, against the out-of-touch plastic man. And if you can't figure out which one's which, I'm not sure you've been, listening to much any politics, but I mean,
right,
that may be the negative of both. The president's too idealistic and probably, they say, wants too much of this, and then Romney, is he,
right,
of course, the worst, they say he's a space figure.
Right.
Somebody that's not really in touch with America. Tim, talk to
right.
the bud.
Yeah, the bud is simple. If you get the impression from listening to me that Mitt Romney can't win, well, nothing could be further from the truth. Absolutely, I think he can win the race. I think the polling shows it. I think he's within striking distance, close enough that something, on a new scale that might happen of a traumatic scenario that could win the presidency for him. I mean, he is positioned as well as Mitt Romney could be positioned right now. Let's put it that way.
I agree. I don't mean to imply that I don't think he can prevail. I just think it's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
Well,
Catherine,
I will disagree a little bit, because I'll tell you, if President Obama's, who we know him as today and who we knew him back in the 2008 campaign, and that campaign, that level of campaign as far as discipline and no real surprises, comes up like it is, and Mitt Romney stays who he is. He didn't go get him a personality transplant by Labor Day. I do think that the president's going to win. I mean, I believe what 528's saying, that things are setting in to where if you look at the projection for now, the projection for later, this is what it is. Now, of course, you can have your October surprise, if you will, although the president, because Bin Laden is not as vulnerable to that kind of thing as I think he would be if Bin Laden was still alive. You know, you could hit him more on foreign policy because, as we know, a lot of these things that are completely out of your control a lot of times are foreign policy based, more or less. And so the president, I mean, Romney hadn't even opened up a line of attack on foreign policy. I don't even know that he has much of a case, but he hadn't even tried.
I don't see why he should. Well, if I were Mitt Romney, the economy is exactly what I would run on. What else would he have, to be honest with you? That would be his best chance to win the White House, is to run on the economy and make a case why he can handle the economy better. Now, that has been his failing, David, so far, at least in my mind. Mitt Romney has not made a convincing case to the American people why he would be better equipped to deal with the economy than the president is.
Yeah, and something I didn't send y'all, but also I guess figures in here, is the president's campaign is starting to talk about Mitt Romney as an outsourcer of jobs, as Bain Capital as being somebody that outsources jobs. And they're saying that that's working, that people are starting to see the connection. So therefore, if basically you say, hey, I can help unemployment in America, and at the same time, the president saying, look, at Bain Capital, Mitt Romney shipped more jobs overseas than he created, then he's going to be weak on what he's trying to run on. It's a lot like what happened to John Kerry when he said, hey, I'm a veteran, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and the Swift vote, you know, campaign destroyed that leg. Now, of course, he was in an environment where he was able to be pretty competitive in the end. But, I mean, it may set Mitt Romney up if he stands on a one-legged stool and the president's campaign is able just to completely knock that out. You know, that hurts him, if you will. So, he's got a risk there, and I guess that kind of segues into our next thing. The Weekly Standard is run by William Kristol. William Kristol's probably a pretty thoughtful conservative. I mean, he's, you know, where if we've talked about the Republican Party, a lot of their candidates aren't maybe the sharpest knives in the drawer. William Kristol's smart. I wouldn't take that away from him. I think he's an intelligent guy, certainly more intelligent than his person he was the chief of staff for, is Dan Quayle. Well, he wrote an article saying that Mitt Romney has all the makings of the next Dukakis or Kerry. And I think he probably uses those two because they're all from Massachusetts. And I guess that's the kiss of death if you're a Republican, because Republicans, they don't care what Massachusetts may have done for our country's history, particularly in the beginning. They'd like to become 49 states, I think, and get rid of Massachusetts, because for some reason that's the state they all hate. And if y'all think I'm wrong on that, tell me so. But what did y'all make of this article? Catherine, what were your thoughts?
I'm going to pass it to Tim first. I just read it, so I need to just put my thoughts together about it.
Okay, Tim.
Yeah, you're right, David. Of course, Bill Kristol is one of the finest conservative minds in the country. I thoroughly enjoy reading his stuff. I thoroughly enjoy listening to him every time he's on television, and he does make some valid points in this particular article. But I hate to beat a dead horse, but the economy is just super important this year. Romney has to run on that. Like I said, what else is he going to run on? He has got to make this a referendum on Obama's domestic policies, or he'll lose. He compares this race to 1988 and 2004, and I can see where he's going with it, except for one thing. The economy right now is much worse than it was in those two election years. We just got to remember that. And I know that the polls show that the American people still blame most of what went on or what has transpired on President Bush, but that only goes so far, and we've got to keep that in our mindset. If this president gets reelected with an unemployment rate above 8%, he's going to be the first president since 1936 to do so, and that was under extraordinary circumstances then. So, you know, people, I'm just giving a little cautionary tale here. What do you think?
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned 36. We're talking about the worst economy since the Great Depression.
Right.
Most people in 1936 felt that President Roosevelt, probably they thought he inherited Hoover's economy. Honestly, he inherited Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover's economy. Because the more you study history, you figure out all three of them together. In some ways, Hoover probably inherited the economy of the first two, but just didn't do anything about it. And so, therefore, there's some similarities. So you begin to see, hey, you know, he may end up getting the benefit of the doubt because there was another poll. And I think this one was before last week, so y'all may have discussed it. But it showed that people, a majority of people, still feel that if you have to say, whose fault is this economy, George W. Bush or Barack Obama, more than 50% say George W. Bush.
Oh, yeah.
And people, and that's going to help him, just like it helped Roosevelt in 36 when people said, this is Hoover's fault. You know, they lived in Hoover towns or Hoovervilles, or what do they call them those days? Catherine, you've had a little more time to reflect. What do you think?
Yeah, and I remembered the point in that article that I really wanted, that I sort of alluded to earlier. It's fine to say, you know, it's all about the economy, and that we've got to shore up the economy, and, you know, the president has done a lousy job on the economy. But people want to know, especially because we're talking about swing voters, and generally speaking, swing voters are more interested in solutions and not just partisan politics. So we need to hear something from Mitt Romney that explains what he's going to do about the economy. Because we're not really hearing it. I mean, we hear, well, we need to, you know, deregulate everything, and that there's too many regulations, but those are not solutions. Those are machinations of an existing system. So I think that they compare the situation to Clinton, and if you recall, Clinton had some very specific ideas that he was putting forward to solve some of the economic problems. So I think that it's not enough to just say he's done a lousy job, I'm going to do a better job. You know, well, how are you going to do it? I think we need to hear more. And those are very difficult things to message on because it's not, you know, a 30-second or, you know, 10-second soundbite. It takes a little bit more crafting of a message to explain exactly what it is that you think will help the economy.
Yeah, and obviously they talked about in that article too, Bill Clinton had all these other issues. And I think that's another thing that helps the president. For instance, health care was one of Bill Clinton's big issues. And I know y'all talked about this last week. I actually think that the president being successful on something as major as health care, people are going to see him as a doer. You know, sometimes, particularly all this gridlock, even if some people don't think of something as being perfect, the fact that you actually got something done is, you know, it counts for something with swing voters. Now, obviously, Democrats will say, hey, that was great. You know, we've been talking about this since at least Harry Truman, I know, first proposed it. It finally got done. Wow, I mean, this is special. But then, of course, even swing voters, the health care bill has gotten more popular by a few points since the Supreme Court ruling. So there's something that's actually accomplishing, and they may not think that Romney can accomplish it.
Yeah, we arrived at one conclusion last week for certain, and that is that had the Supreme Court ruled the other way, it would have been absolutely devastating for the president. So there's no way, I don't think, that the Republicans can spin this as anything but a win for the president, in that his signature thing that he's done in his presidency domestically has survived. Right, Catherine?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's going to segue into that topic later about Mitt Romney and health care. But first, let's get to one of our ever-popular rankings or games, if you will. And since they mentioned back to Dukakis, I wanted us to rank pretty much all of the major party losers since 88. Now, we're going to leave out George Bush because he won and then lost. So he actually served as president. He was an incumbent. That's a little tricky. It wasn't like he was a new face on the scene, or at least running for his first time, if you will, in 92. And also, I didn't want to include Perot since that was a hard to quantify the two times he ran. So that leaves us with Michael Dukakis, Bob Dole, Al Gore, John Kerry, John McCain, and Mitt Romney. And I believe that's six people. And I don't mind letting one of y'all go first if you have your ranking ready. But if you're like, David, I want to hear yours first, I don't mind going through my six in order. Catherine, would you like to do your ranking, or you want to pass the team?
I'd like you to
happened?
Go first.
Okay, Catherine would like me to go first, so I will. And I'll go top to bottom. I believe that the best of those six was Al Gore. Now, Al Gore, you could say, should have won walking away and not even let it be so close, but he did win the popular vote. I think there's a lot of us believe he probably won the election. The votes just weren't counted properly or because of the butterfly ballots in Florida. But to me, he's my top one. You know, when you actually win the popular vote, that ought to count for something when you're ranking this list. After that, I'm going to go ahead and it's hard to say which one, but I guess Kerry came the next closest to winning. You know, he uses the phrase, oh, if you could have taken the people that would fit in Ohio State's football stadium and switched their votes, then I would have been elected president. And, of course, if you went to Ohio State football stadium and looked, you'd probably like a whole lot of people. But then when you talk about millions and millions of people casting their votes for president, it is a pretty close race. The next one in my rankings was John McCain. Now, John McCain didn't come close. He was never in any real jeopardy of winning after about July anyway. But that was just he was inheriting the Republican Party brand of George Bush, and that was too much to overcome. But there was a lot of things that people liked about him, the fact that he was the maverick. He had supported campaign finance reform. I think that meant that a lot of people on the other side of the aisle didn't hate him. He had, of course, had his POW veteran status, which a lot of people respected. Going from there, Bob Dole, I'm going to rank him next. Once again, he was just caught in a bad election where people just really thought the incumbent president was dynamic, and I don't think a lot of people were going to win in 96 anyway, and they just – you know, they gave it Dole the nomination. There wasn't much to do with it. And then next, I'm going to rank Dukakis. Dukakis actually led the race at points, although it's hard to believe, but lost pretty handily. I think people were tired of Reaganomics, just couldn't capitalize. And, of course, I guess the one defining moment of Michael Dukakis' career, for right or wrong, was the way he responded to the question about his wife being murdered. Now, of course, there's a lot of people that don't believe in the death penalty, but they probably at least want to show a little passion when people are talking about your wife getting executed. I mean, you could say, look, I'd want to kill the guy with my bare hands, but, and then you explain why you're against the death penalty. He never did that, so that's why he ranks so low in my mind. And then finally, Mitt Romney. I mean, this guy is just a total, you know, mannequin, if you will. I mean, all the other people have, to me, more interesting things about him than him, and that's, to me, how weak a candidate is. The fact that he's within 1 or 2 points shows that there are a lot of Republicans out there that are, you know, hurting with the economy, if you will, and they want something different. But I just think the fact that he is so weak is going to come back to bite him, and I think the Republicans are for years and years going to say, what a lost opportunity if we would have, you know, nominated somebody better. And that may be right or wrong, but I do think they're going to come back over and over and talk about how they could have done better out of their nomination process. That's my six. Tim, you want to go tell yours?
Sure. I have something quite different. Although we share the number one position, I clearly think of those six, candidates. Al Gore was the the superior one of the six. I mean, not only the fact that he won the popular vote, as you said, but what he's gone on and accomplished since that time, too. I mean, the guy's got an Academy Award and a Nobel Prize, you know. That's pretty good day's work there. But, see, you've got Mitt Romney last. I've got Mitt Romney number two. And I'm comparing Mitt Romney to these other people. And I think that in a weak election field, Romney was clearly the best one of the Republicans that was nominated this year. I do believe, as you do, that because of the economy, that's why he is so close, and in any other year he would be getting pasted. But I think this guy's got enough in him. I think he's got enough of a background to pull this thing off. I really do. What I'm watching for is to see what happens when the Republicans open the money spigots, because so far the president's campaign has been outspending them, especially in these toss-up states. I want to see what happens when all this money the Republicans are raising starts pouring out on television and stuff like that. So I've got him number two. I've got John McCain, as you did, number three. I would have had him number two, but I'm sorry. You got to be penalized for picking Sarah Palin, right? I mean, you do. I think John McCain is a great American, but I'm sorry. Mama Grizzly is an idiot. And I bet he's wished a million times over he hadn't picked her and opened that Pandora's box. I've got John Kerry, number four. I think the election was winnable in 2004, and I think that Senator Kerry did not run a good campaign. I think he allowed himself to the swift vote thing wasn't what got me. The thing that got me was him standing by and allowing himself to be branded a flip-flopper. And it stuck. Number five, I've got Bob Dole. He's a good man, but he was not a good candidate for president at all. It's shameful that he's remembered for that race in 96. And I easily got Michael Dukakis, number six. My goodness, that poor man was so dry, so boring. And Roger Ailes and the Republicans just ran over him. So that's what I've got.
Tim, I'll get into it later why I'm right and you're wrong. But the biggest difference we had was Romney. And, of course, that just shows you've been reading too much Hedgehog Report while I'm Republican.
Of course. That's what it is.
They've soured your
David,
mind. Because that's what's happened there, Tim. Catherine, did
you reckon?
Okay, I gotta, you know, go with everyone on Al Gore. Of course, you know, he ran a good campaign, and it, you know, a lot of us think it was stolen. So, and he won the popular vote and all that. And like Tim said, he has done a lot of good work since then. Second, I'm gonna say John McCain. Actually, I think that. Even though Sarah Palin, I can't give him any credit for that, but I think, you know, it was a pretty close race against a very dynamic candidate, President Obama, and I mainly give him that because I don't have the same. I really don't have the same, can't give the same credit to Kerry that everyone else did. I would say Romney third, because, again, I do think, like Tim said, as disappointing as he is very close, and it really shouldn't be for such a weak candidate. If the, like we said, if the economy were in better shape, he would be a, you know, he would be at, you know, 25 points or something. And then I'm going to say Cary. And the reason I put Cary down so far is that there is, in the situation that we faced in 2004 with 4 years of incredibly bad decisions and bad judgment and poor leadership from President Bush, for us to not be able to pull that out with John Kerry, it's just shocking. It still shocks me when I think back to that election.
Mm-hmm.
As hard as we all worked, I mean, we worked hard, even though, you know, a lot of us who were supporting other candidates prior to Kerry getting the nomination and weren't too enthusiastic about Kerry, we still worked very hard to try to get the vote out. So I think that was a huge disappointment and a real low point for the Democratic Party in this country. And Bob Dole. Bob Dole, absolutely the worst Republican candidate. I mean, he was just cranky and unpleasant and, you know, made so many gaffes. And he was just a terrible. I mean, like Tim said, he was a good man. And he, I think he was a good senator. And I think he worked well with other senators and other Democrats, but he was a terrible candidate. And yeah, Dukakis, you know, that was one of the first elections that I really was involved in, you know, volunteering in. And that was a huge disappointment, too. He had a lot of things going against him. The whole Willie Horton thing was bad, but he really wasn't very presidential. And I know that it would be nice if we didn't think about that, but the fact is, people respond the way people look and their charisma or lack thereof. And he just was not presidential enough to prevail, in my opinion. And that was all, that was the problem for those of us who voted, who nominated him too. It wasn't just him. I mean, we nominated him. So, but that's my ranking.
Yeah, I'm gonna take issue with each of y'all on one thing. Catherine, I think you got this right, and this is where Tim got it wrong. John McCain and Mitt Romney went head-to-head, and John McCain won. So, to me, I mean, he beat him head-to-head in 2008, so that's one reason I'll say that I would argue that John McCain would get the due over Mitt Romney. Now, Catherine, I agree with you that Bob Dole was cranky. You might even say he was mean. But if
he
had to describe Mitt Romney in one word, one adjective, I think a lot of people pick weird. And I'll be honest, I think most people in America will take ornery, angry, cranky over weird. And, I mean, I think that's going to be his undoing. People are going to think this guy's strange.
I disagree.
He carries himself.
I don't know if I've ever told you guys this story, but in the 96 election, I used to watch the Today Show every morning. And Bob Dole was on one morning, and with his wife Elizabeth, and Katie Couric, who was like America's sweetheart, right? At the time, she was like all that. Everybody loved her, and she was interviewing them, and he like lost his temper with Katie Couric, like of all the people to lose your temper with, at 7:30 on a weekday morning, was Katie Couric. And I remember standing there looking at the TV and saying, Bob Dole just lost the election. Millions of people were watching it, and he just went off on her. He started yelling at her. Like, he just was mean. And I think we don't like people to do that. It's one thing if you yell at, the bald guy from New Orleans. But Katie Couric, I mean, her husband had just died. You know, I mean, it was just like, You expect people to have a certain demeanor if they're running for president, and he did not have that.
Well, and we do hear about politicians in private that will yell, or in a lot of people off fields, so, you know, put on a public face, put on a private face. I think a lot of people just said, well, Dole just doesn't put on a public face. He just
right.
is who he is. He's a grumpy old man.
Yeah.
And, of course, we had seen movie Grumpy Old Men for a long time then. We saw the President's movie, James Garner and Jack Lemmon. He just seemed like the Jack Lemmon character. Tim, you're going to tell me something. You're going to tell me either, A, that people don't think Mitt Romney's weird, or that cranky's worse than weird.
No, no, I'm going to make my case a little bit since you pounded on me, okay? No, they don't look at Romney as weird. What stuck to him is privileged and detached. Right. That's something he's got to work on. He's Mr. Rich Guy riding around on his jet ski with his wife driving two Cadillacs to their four houses with a dog on the roof of the car that don't connect to the average American. This is the problem that President Bush ran into in 1992, like with the famous incident with the scanner in the supermarket. And that's Romney's problem. But for you to tell me with a straight face that Mitt Romney is a worse candidate than Michael Dukakis, I'm sorry, that is laughable. We're talking about a guy that won 10 states against Bush 41. And had the campaign gone on any longer, I think he might have eventually found a way to lose all the states. He was a horrid, horrid candidate, terrible candidate. I don't see it there. And there's a reason John McCain beat Romney 4 years ago. Republicans normally pick out a guy and say, okay, it's his turn. 4 years ago, it was John McCain's turn. This year, it's Mitt Romney's turn. Republicans historically nominate favorites, with few exceptions. So that's my case. How about that?
Yeah, I tell you what, if it's Mitt Romney's turn, they need to make a new line.
That's why he got the nomination. It's his turn.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I mean, we've talked every once in a while. Something will come up with Saturday Night Live, and we'll talk about it. And to me, I mean, basically, their whole attack on Romney, if you will, or their satire of Romney, is that he is not an earthling. I mean, you know, when it came to Dole, yeah, they show the cranky old man. When it came to George Bush, the first one, they'd show this awkward guy. With George W. Bush, the son, they showed this guy that wasn't really smart but had a lot of arrogance to kind of cover it up. With Mitt Romney, they're saying that he's a space alien. Have they ever done this? And it sticks. I mean, people are kind of like, I mean, nobody thinks he's really from outer space, but they're like, yeah, that's kind of how the guy is. He's kind of weird. And
well,
that is just not a good place to be.
It's
going to get worse and worse for him.
It's the likability factor, David. In my lifetime, only Richard Nixon won when he was the less likable of the two candidates, and that's because of Vietnam, obviously. In all other presidential elections in my lifetime, the more likable candidate won the election. Romney's got to work on that, right?
Yeah. I'll agree with you. I think we're going to have a guest here coming up any minute based on an email I just got. Of course, anybody wants to call in, remember the number, including our guest, number 646-478-4503. But let's try to cover one more thing quickly before our special guest comes on. And that was the USA Today, on the Monday USA Today, and of course, if you're definitely in a hotel if you're in the USA Today, I found. It had in the state capsule, and if you hadn't seen it, they'll do one little blurb on every state, and it's usually something local going on. Well, in addition to that, on Monday's USA Today, they had the percentage of every state's uninsured residents. And the lowest state, the state that had 2% of their population uninsured, was Massachusetts. Now, of course, we know that was because of Romney Care.
Mm-hmm.
And now my question is, do we give Mitt Romney credit for this amazing feat, or do we have to take away that credit because the president said, hey, this is a good idea, let's put it in the other 49 states, and now Mitt Romney says, no, let's take that away. I was wrong about my old plan that was actually successful. Catherine, do we give him the credit, or do we have to take it away?
I think we have to give him the credit, but, I mean, give him the credit for when he was governor for, you know, doing it, but then sort of give him some demerits for distancing himself from it now. I mean, thank you for doing it when you were there. I mean, I'm sure the people in Massachusetts appreciate it. And as a country, it's a model that we think we might be able to use in some ways around the country. But for him to then distance himself from it is kind of weak.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen a situation where somebody does something like this on a plan. I mean, usually when you come up with something winning, you want to take credit for and expand it, right, Tim?
Yes, you do. Mitt, I want to give Governor Romney all the credit and loudly, and I hope the media does that too, because Governor Romney does not really want to talk about that right now, right?
And it's crazy, though. I mean, basically, I mean, you would think that, you know, most people in America would say people not having health insurance is not a good thing. Now,
but
of course, there's some political Republicans.
But how is he going to attack the Affordable Care Act when it was modeled after what he did in Massachusetts? That's why he doesn't want to talk about Romney Care.
Oh, I know, but it's just a bizarro world that he can't take credit for one of his better achievements as governor, but that it's just a strange thing. And once again, makes it mind-boggling that he actually won the nomination. Well, we've got the last quarter of the show left, and we have our special guest, State House candidate Jason Estevez with us. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, how are you?
Sorry about that. Oh, no problem. It was my bad on the number. I guess in my vacationing, I thought I had gotten that to you a little quicker. But we're still in good shape. Jason, you're running in a district that's kind of pieces of an old district, if you will. And so it's not exactly an open seat, but it's not exactly a true incumbency either.
Right. I call it a quasi-incumbency.
Yeah. Well, go ahead and give us the listeners a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm an attorney here in Atlanta. I practice business and commercial litigation, and I live on the west side of town, District 53, which is, as you mentioned before, a combined district between Districts 44 and 53. 53 was represented by Representative Ellie Dobbs, and District 44 is represented by Representative Sheila Jones. And those two districts were combined when the lines were drawn by the legislature. And Ellie Dobbs decided to step down. And when I heard that, I thought that District 53 needed someone who was going to be active and making sure things were going on the west side of town. So I jumped in the race.
Yes. Well, so you're an attorney and living there. How long have you – it sounds like you've been in Georgia pretty much your whole life. How long have you lived in West Atlanta?
I've lived in West Atlanta for 2 years. I'm actually from Columbus, Georgia, and spent most of my life there. I went to the University of Miami, and after Miami, I went to teach for 2 years as part of the Teach for America program. I don't know if y'all have heard of that.
Yes.
Program, but I did that for 2 years in Houston, Texas, and then eventually got the desire to want to come back to Georgia. So instead of going back down to Columbus again, I went to Emory Law School and stayed in Atlanta ever since, and have found that the west side of town is my home and a place I plan on being for the rest of my life.
Yeah, in Georgia roots, and I think actually that is a kind of a good profile to have grown up in one part of the state and then live in another part of the state, because a lot of times in the state legislature, you don't decide things just for your little corner of Georgia. I mean, there are things going on across the state, and you'll have two perspectives of it instead of just one, and so I don't think it's a bad thing when I brought that up. Well, I've got Catherine Smith and Tim Shiflett both here with me, and I don't want to hog up all the time, so I'm going to pass it on to Tim first. Tim, your questions for Jason Estevez.
Yes, sir, and welcome to the Cut, Subban, Jason. Thank you for being on with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
You have been both a teacher and an attorney. Now, that's two pretty good careers. So, all of a sudden, why politics now?
Yeah, and I think the teacher and attorney, Let me throw out one note out there that hopefully not too many of your listeners are from my law firm or from or our attorneys, but teaching is by far the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I did that because I wanted to do Teach for America and take 2 years off before doing anything else. And teaching was a natural choice because I was raised wanting to give back to the community. That's what my parents instilled in me very early on. And that was a good way to do it while I figured out what I wanted to do with my life. While I was teaching, and I was teaching 150 kids down in Houston, Texas, middle school social studies, and I quickly realized that they were in an environment that put them on a path for failure for no reason of their own. I mean, this is just simply because of where they lived, who their parents were. They were down on a path for failure. And I wanted to change that. I tried my hardest to do that while I taught them. And as my two-year commitment wound down, I tried to think about what else could I do. And that's when I became interested in law, because I figured that the legal degree would give me the flexibility I needed to, you know, affect policy, but also pay back some of my student loans and work for the private sector while I did that. So I went to law school and did pretty well in law school and ended up being a corporate attorney. And while that is very lucrative and a very good career, it was not as rewarding as teaching was. So I sought out opportunities to bring back that feeling of fulfillment, and I got back that feeling when I realized that serving my community fulfilled me a lot more than doing anything else. And that's
okay.
What brought me back to politics.
Okay, so with your background as a teacher, in your opinion, is education still the biggest issue for the Georgia legislature to deal with?
Absolutely, and unfortunately, it's always on the back burner for the Georgia legislature. It is one of those issues that affects every single one of us, whether you have kids or you don't have kids. Our public education system will determine where Georgia goes in the future. For example, this past recession, we had employers here in Georgia who had job opportunities that could not be filled. They couldn't be filled simply because the population was not educated enough to fill those jobs. They were not qualified. That is one of those things that if we had a top-notch education system, I can guarantee you that we would have plenty of folks here in Georgia who could have filled those positions. Unfortunately, since 2002 and for a little bit longer than that, public education system has been in the back burner, and it's unfortunately one of the first things to get cut when times get tough, and it's the last thing to get replenished when things are great again. So education is without a doubt the number one issue that we are dealing with. And until we fix education and make sure that every child has access to an excellent education, we're going to have troubles in the state.
Excellent answer. Thank you, sir. Catherine?
Hey, Jason. Thanks a lot for being on tonight. It's nice to hear your voice again. We've met a couple times. I just need to make sure everybody knows that. I wanted to ask you about your district. So I live on the west side, but I live farther south, I guess, than your district. Can you just give me and the listeners the sort of boundaries of the district?
Yeah, so it includes a lot of historic neighborhoods. It's a very diverse district. It has some of the richest folks in Atlanta and some of the poorest folks in the city as well. It includes the historic neighborhoods of Paces Ferry, the Paces neighborhood. Intersection of 75 and Paces Ferry Road.
Okay.
It goes, if you're going north on 75, the district starts with Collier Road, where Collier Road goes under 75. Anything to the left as you're driving up 75 north, anything to the left is part of the district all the way until you get to Paces Ferry and 75. Okay.
And
so
what's the border on the other side, Atlanta Road?
The border on the other side is part of Atlanta Road, goes all the way west to the Chattahoochee River.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's a little exception to that, where South Atlanta Road and South Cobb Drive are parallel to each other. It includes a little part of Smyrna Vinings.
Okay.
And it goes all the way east to Cumberland Parkway.
Okay.
All the way west, all the way west to Cumberland Parkway. So it includes the historic neighborhoods of Paces, Collier Heights, Adamsville, the Bolton Road area, some of the Bankhead Corridor. So it includes a very diverse area.
It is a very diverse district, but it's not one of the ribbon districts like the other districts in mostly in Atlanta, like Tyrone Brooks district. Anyway, I also wanted to ask you how the campaign is going and what kind of activities how you're approaching the district. Are you walking the district? Are you doing mailings? You know, what's your approach?
My approach is to do it all. Everything you mentioned, we are doing it. The district, most of the voters, the reliable voters in the district are going to be senior citizens. And those are the voters that historically, in the past, have voted for my opponent, one of my opponents. And what we have to make sure is that they get my name in their minds and that we hit them with enough contact and enough information that they're convinced that I'm the person that they should vote for. So we're doing that in person. We're doing that through telephone. We're doing that through mail. That takes money, but that also takes a lot of hard work from me because they want to see
it
me.
It does.
So I've knocked on over 2,500 doors myself. There's several thousand more of that we're trying to get to before election time, between me and my volunteers. But me personally, I have knocked on 2,500 doors, spoken to hundreds of people in the process, and I like it because when I speak to people at the doors, they're like, "Oh, you're the candidate? You must be running a grassroots campaign. That must mean you don't have any money." And that's exactly what I want them to think, because we're also going to be hitting them with mail and telephone, live calls as well. So I've been out there fundraising very aggressively, and we are pretty comfortable with the fact that we have outraised not only our main opponent, but there's another person in the race as well, and I believe he was on your show several months ago. But I want to make sure that I have all the resources, and I'm working the hardest as well, because I think that's what it's going to take to win against an incumbent, or as in this race, a quasi-incumbent.
Right. And then I wanted to ask you, when you're talking to voters, what are their main? I know it's a very diverse district. What are the concerns? What are the top two concerns that people are expressing?
Yeah, the first one is like Tim mentioned, the education system. Our public education system, and particularly when you look at the schools in the northwest side of Atlanta, which my district encompasses, we have a lot of failing schools in that district, and parents have very little options. So a lot of our discussion surrounds the fact that I will be an advocate for public education when I go to the Georgia legislature. And I want to make sure that people know that while I'm an advocate for education, that doesn't mean that I'm going to just side with one party or the other, teachers, parents, students. At this point, it's about making sure that our kids have access to an excellent public school education, an excellent free school that they can go to close to their neighborhood. So that's the first issue. And the second issue is the fact that on the northwest side of Atlanta, and Catherine, you're not too far from this, although you're a little bit closer to Midtown, I think.
Yes, I am.
In northwest Atlanta, we have a very big food desert where we have no access or very little access to grocery stores. The ones we do have are very small. We have little access to restaurants. And the restaurants we do have are fast food restaurants. and the shopping centers that we have are half empty. What we do have a lot of are abandoned homes and unfortunately dumping grounds. We were Northwest Atlanta is a place where people go and they dump their tires. So what people want to see is our elected officials who are dedicated to bringing the northwest side of Atlanta back to its prominence. And as I mentioned before, we have very historic neighborhoods in the district. We have Collier Heights. We have Adamsville. We have Tasis Ferry. We have Margaret Mitchell. A lot of great neighborhoods that deserve more attention than what they're receiving. And that's what I'm telling people. I'll work my heart out to make sure that they're receiving the representation that they deserve in Northwest Atlanta.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take it back to David.
Yes, well, Jason, we want to thank you for joining us on the Cubs Divine, but one final thing we always want to offer to our candidate guests. If somebody's heard you and they say, I want to support Jason, what are some ways they can do that and how can they do that?
The main way for me is definitely spreading the word, spreading the word about me, telling people who live in Northwest Atlanta, whether they live in the district or live right outside of the district, tell them about Jason Estevez and that you heard them on Kudzu, you heard him on Kudzu Vine, and you thought he did a pretty good job and that he would serve you well. The second thing is come out and volunteer. We're always looking for folks to knock on doors and make telephone calls for us. While I'm knocking on tons of doors, there are some doors I won't be able to get to. So that's where volunteers come on in and help me with that. And they can do all that by going on our website, jasonestevez.com. That's spelled jasonestevez.com and signing up on the website. So those are the two main ways, spreading the word and volunteering.
Yes. Well, Jason, I want to tell you, if anybody hadn't gone on Jason's website, it's a really solid-looking website. And actually do this as beside job, besides teaching. And so I thought it actually had a nice look to it and good photography. And I don't say that about all our guests, but I want to tell you that. And also I just want to thank you for being on the show and good luck in the last few weeks of this campaign.
Thank you so much. And once I win, I'd love to come back on and talk to you all more about the issues.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Well, and that's the remainder of our show, but that's okay. Jason closed us off nicely and went in a little recorded time, so people can catch that as well. But it's been the Kudzu Vine. It's been good to be back. Tim, Catherine?
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Evening.